Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and we'll come back in a little bit to the aftermath of the Boston Marathon attack. Right now, a very special guest, one of the core founders of the Occupy movement, David Graeber, whose day job is teaching anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London. His last book was Debt, The First 5,000 Years, and now he's written The Democracy Project, A History, A Crisis, A Movement. David, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
And part of the book is your narrative of your involvement in the Occupy movement. You've spoken before here about how you and others planned a September 2011 action during the summer of that year. Looking back, what do you think have been the Occupy movement's greatest accomplishments now?
Well, I think first and foremost, we put the issue not only of social class, but actually class power back in the conversation, back on the agenda of American politics. Nobody's really managed to do that since the 1930s. I strongly suspect we managed by changing the discourse, we could very likely have a President Romney if it wasn't for ideas like the 99% floating around.
And he kind of played into it with the 47%.
Indeed.
Do you think that had more resonance because people were already thinking in terms of these percentages?
Absolutely. I mean, when he was planning his campaign, he assumed being a Wall Street financier was going to be seen as a good thing.
Listeners, if you want to talk to David Graeber, one of the founders of the Occupy movement, 212-433-WNYC. We're also going to get into big ideas of democracy and anarchy and history and the future.
Great.
212-433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But is the Occupy movement over?
Oh, no. I mean, we're still out there. We have a problem in that we don't have a space. There was a decision made probably not even on the city level, on the national level, that they didn't care what the law said. They were not going to allow us to reestablish any sort of space. So when you don't have a place where people can come, it's hard for people to plug in. They think we're fading out, but we're not. I mean, everybody's still out there. We have projects like Strike Dead, Occupy Sandy, with very large numbers of people involved doing all sorts of exciting things.
Getting word now, by the way, that President Obama is going to speak about Boston at 11:30, so that's going to shorten a couple of our guests, unfortunately, including David Graeber, but President Obama at 11:30, and we will take that live. So your last book was Debt, mm-hmm. The First 5,000 Years, and we know how that relates in the immediate present or recent past to what went on in this country. A look at the history of debt and economic inequality over millennia. Does your new book, The Democracy Project, build on that in any way?
Well, it has a similar historical sweep in that it's not as a long, intensive book on one topic. But I do look into the history of the idea of democracy, which is not what we usually think it is.
What do you think it is?
Well, the first thing that I discovered when I was researching the book is that we have this idea, well, democracy is a thing that was sort of given us by these wise men, the founding fathers. If you read what the founding fathers actually said, they're really explicit. They were all totally against democracy. I mean, they would say things. So the opening remarks in the Constitutional Convention begin by saying, we have a problem. There's way too much democracy in this country. What are we going to do about it? Yet, despite that, the fact that they create this system, which they call a republic based on Rome and not on Greece, which is meant to contain and even suppress democracy, by the 1830s, everybody's relabeling that system democracy because people like the idea of democracy and people who call themselves Democrats win elections. So the question I'm asking is, even though all the intellectuals of the time, all the politicians hated democracy and were trying to suppress it, why is it people liked it anyway to the point where democratic elements crept in?
But is that too blanket a write-off of the founders of the country? I mean, they were trying to get away from a system where a king, an occupying king, could tell everybody what to do. And they wanted to be able to spread decision-making around incompletely, to be sure. You know, land-holding males are the ones who had the vote. But they wanted to, spread decision around, have checks and balances, have, compromise between the various states, et cetera, et cetera.
They did, but they wanted it to be steered in such a way that there was no majority rule. And they said that quite explicitly. There's a quote from John Adams saying, majority rule. Are you crazy? We have 1 or 2 million people with property. We have 9 million people without. What do you think is going to happen? They're going to cancel the debts. They're going to redistribute the land. We can't have that.
And you contrast that non-democracy that you say the founding was with pirate ships,
well,
which
that was an
you
example,
call
yeah.
one of the best examples of early American democracy.
Well, as far as we know, pirate ships were incredibly democratically organized. We have this image of these pirate captains as being these little tyrants. But in fact, pirate captains, for the most part, could only give commands during chase or combat. Otherwise, they just had one vote like everybody else. Most of the places where that kind of democratic improvisation comes from were spaces like that. They were kind of out just on the fringes of the state where you have a lot of different sorts of people. Pirates were mostly mutineers. They had people from all over the world suddenly having to collaborate. And that's where democratic creativity comes from.
So what's important about – well, where would your priorities be going forward to make the United States, just to stay in the domestic realm, mm-hmm. more democratic than it is?
Well, what we were trying to do in Occupy is to create a culture of democracy. How do you have 20, 100, 1,000 people sit in a room or in a square and begin to practice democratic deliberation, decision making? We don't have a culture of that. And even in places in the world where you wouldn't imagine there is such a culture, often you find it. Well, when I lived in Madagascar, which in terms of its national organization, not particularly democratic right now. On the other hand, ordinary people know how to do that. We don't. So the first thing you have to do is learn how to go about making egalitarian decisions.
But egalitarian decisions in a relatively leaderless context, certainly in Zuccotti Park, but can that scale up to the level of, say, the House of Representatives?
Well, no, in the sense of representative democracy is – the interesting thing about representative democracy, and this is another thing I discovered when writing the book, is that it was never considered democracy at all until quite recently. When they decided to relabel elections as a democratic idea, that was an innovation introduced in the 18th century. It's not like they didn't have elections. They were having elections in England back in 1200s, so maybe even 1100s.
But would you be a fan then of initiative and referendum, which a lot of progressives oppose today? Even though it's more direct democracy, it often winds up with a populist reactionary agenda.
It can. That's very important. I actually have trouble with the idea of plebiscites because tyrants like plebiscites. There are ways of designing them, and people have been working on this, and say the Pirate Party in Germany, trying to come up with ways of doing that electronically that wouldn't be biased in that way. But there's a lot of work. I actually think we need to think creatively about these questions. One of the most exciting ideas, this is what I was moving toward before, when in the Middle Ages, in the ancient world, when people thought about elections, they thought that was aristocratic. You get a bunch of people who claim they're the best, and then you choose which one is the best at all. You know what the democratic mode of selecting officials was? It was lottery. It's basically like jury duty, except it wasn't compulsory. Anybody who happens to want to have public office, throw their name in a hat. You give them a literacy test, basic sanity. And if they're okay, well, you choose one out of a hat.
So Ted Cruz could be the next president if he happens to come up.
Well, I think William F. Buckley, I don't agree with him on much, but once he said, I'd rather be governed by the first 200 names in the New York phone book than the current inhabitants of Congress. I think a lot of people would agree on that.
David Graeber, author of Debt, one of the four core founders of the Occupy movement, his new book, The Democracy Project, A History, A Crisis, A Movement. And Richard in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with David Graeber. Hello.
Hi. How's it going, Brian? Hi, David.
Hello.
So I had a question about the slogan of we are the 99%, and I chanted it myself when I participated in Occupy Wall Street. But since 2011, this argument has come up many times with the same circles that I participated in OWS with, which is that the slogan of we are the 99% kind of flattened the wide variety and wide number of experiences that constituted the Occupy Wall Street movement, that it sort of became reduced to this idea that open class conflict, that that a number of sort of other agenda items and ways of thinking of ourselves and diversity within our own communities was sort of flattened out.
Well, yeah, I understand the question.
Yeah.
The question is like, you know, are we ignoring very even more important differences? And I would say you got to start with something. I mean, a slogan isn't an analysis. It's a slogan. It's a starting point. It's a way of beginning to think about something. And what we were trying to throw out is to say that, you know, before we think about our differences, let's think about what's really important about our similarities. And then we can discuss everything else. I mean, past social movements have been starting from all the differences between us. And it's been a mire that's really been a stumbling block for any kind of effective organizing. If we start by saying, look, in a certain way, we have something in common here, and then start talking about all the complications of that, well, you have a basis to actually resolve those things.
You categorically reject violence.
I mean, I don't see any point in it here. If somebody in Chiapas feels they have to do it, I rest judgment. But I can't imagine what the point would be. But, you know, it also depends on how you define it. Some people define violence so absurdly that, you know, when a bunch of nuns hammer at a nuclear missile, they're doing, you know, they're doing violence. I don't agree with that.
You also, though, define and describe anarchism in the book. And people often use the word anarchist to refer to the more radical fringe of the Occupy movement or those who went violent at the old WTO protests in Seattle in 1999, and that anarchists and anarchism is not compatible with democracy. Are they at all opposed to each other, or do they overlap to some degree in a Venn diagram?
Well, the irony is that, in fact, it was largely anarchists who created these forms of direct democracy or urged these forms of direct democracy. At the very beginning of ODS, it was the anarchists who pushed for the General Assembly, for consensus, for almost all the things which made it what it was. And, you know, we have – people don't – it doesn't compute, so people don't put two and two together and realize what's going on. But – you know, what anarchists believe in is a society without systematic bureaucracies of compulsion. Anarchist organization could be anyone you don't have to enforce with weapons. What we were trying to come up with was forms of decision-making where you don't need to have police or armies to enforce the decisions, where that's why you need to come to some kind of consensus.
The anarchism in the book, as you do, as without rulers, and then writing the easiest way to explain anarchism is either – is to say that it is a political movement that aims to bring about a genuinely free society.
Precisely.
And that defines a free society as one where humans only enter into those kinds of relations with one another that would not have to be enforced by the constant threat of violence. So my question as we run out of time is how is that difference, that definition of anarchism, different from libertarianism, which also doesn't want any rulers?
Well, the difference between us and libertarians, there are libertarian – well, the word libertarian is actually invented by anarchists. It originally meant libertarian socialist or libertarian communist. In a way, liberal used to mean free market guys, but then the moderate left in America stole the word liberal. So the free market right had to choose to take the word libertarian from us anarchists. But the basic difference is we don't think that the kind of vast inequalities of property that these people seem to assume would be sustainable without coercion.
And there we leave it with David Graeber, his new book, The Democracy Project, A History, A Crisis, A Movement. Thank you very much for coming in.
Been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, food economist Jason Lusk takes on what he calls the food police, including Mayor Bloomberg, Mark Bittman, and Michelle Obama. Stay with us.